One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, I think we can start. Go ahead, you want to...
All right, we were talking about, what were we talking about?
The voiceover agent.
The voiceover agent, if, there has to be, it's something I would need to do in order to get any kind of work, but at the same time, it's very hard to break into that system.
What is so difficult about getting an agent?
Well, it's sort of like a catch-22 thing. Why is this clicking, by the way?
It's going to click.
It's all right.
It's like
okay.
Doing that.
If the agent doesn't see you, then he can't represent you. But how do you get him to see you if he doesn't know who you are? So you have to hope that you send out enough material and you bug him for so long and you keep sending your picture, resume, or appearing until finally somebody someday says, all right, I'll go to see this guy or whoever, and maybe that's how you get him. You may get it through a referral. A friend of mine said he would introduce me to an agent in New York, but I have not actually done this because I felt unless I moved there permanently, which is unlikely, I would not avail myself of the opportunities. I mean, in Pittsburgh, there's no need for an agent. I mean, we don't have that many opportunities to act, and it's sort of a closed shop here in Pittsburgh. The same people over and over again get parts. I may be sounding a little bit bitter, but sometimes I get that way because I've been acting in Pittsburgh a long time, but I have not had many opportunities. For example, I still haven't worked at the Public Theater, and I've been auditioning there for 12 years.
And also, Pittsburgh has become sort of a hub for some movie making, hasn't it?
Yes, but that also is a big disaster because back in a few years ago, we had at least 10 or 12 movies being made here a year, and then there were some union problems because we were using non-union help. And so the unions in New York just busted the whole thing up, and now we get one or two movies a year. For example, Superman with Michael Keaton, I think, is coming into Pittsburgh in the spring, and who knows, it may provide some work. But the funny thing is that the amount of work is being denied by the very unions that promote work. So that worries me. But in any case...
Are those the Teamsters?
I think so. To give you an idea of how bad this is, last year in New York, I read this in the a New York newspaper, they did 201 movies in New York. And here in Pittsburgh, we did maybe three or four at the most. So this is not an area any longer that is now in hot demand by Hollywood. And a lot of the film companies are going to Toronto because it's even cheaper up there. And there may even be less problems with the union up there. I don't know that. But in any case, I have made one movie, Passed Away, which was in 1992. I still receive residuals from it, from the Walt Disney Company. The last residual that is a check for my services was $9.35. I'm not rolling in money over that. I had one line. It was cut out. But I'm in the movie. And if you rent the video tape, I'm there. I'm also on the back of the video where my bald head is, but it's blocked by Maureen Stapleton, who blocks my face, but you see this part, the top part of my head.
Did you get to know
Not really. She said she was very sick that day on the set. She had a heavy head cold, and I believe her line to me was, when the hell are we going to start shooting the scene again? We had been shooting it for 3 hours, and she was tired of it, and I was tired of it, and the director... I don't know, he couldn't get it together, and then finally he cut my line but left me in the movie. I'm at an Irish wake, and I'm wandering around a room, and you just see me there. A lot of Pittsburgh actors were in that, including the late Don Brockett, and he was very funny, and there were a couple other people. There's a woman named Alice Eisner, who I know well. She has a daughter who lives in New York, she used to be an actress, or still is, I don't know, but Alice has been doing movie bits for years, and is very funny. She gets into all this stuff. Anyway, so that's what the movie business thing is. So I just want to bring you up to date on that. I guess Well, let me see. I don't. I'm trying to fill in gaps that I didn't say on the last tape. I want to add something about somebody in my family, and not really a family member, but was discussed in this previous tape. Connie Schuller, S-C-H-U-L-L-E-R. Her real name was Mary Constance Supko. And she came to, my father got her to come to the house in 1940 in November of that year. I was 8 months old, and she was sort of like a housekeeper who was there. She'd come in 2 days a week. She lived different parts. At one point she lived in Oakland, and at one point she lived in New Kensington, and she was married. And she continued coming to the house as helped out for the next 28 years. And in effect, I would say she was like my second mother. I thought she was the greatest thing. We went to Beach Haven. When my mother and father were out at their fancy cocktail parties, Connie and I were playing miniature golf and going to the movies and going in the ocean and taking long walks. And she was a terrific person. She taught me how to play cards. She had a very limited education. She had only gone to eighth grade, the Catholic school system, and remember the nuns and all the bad things that happened there. But at the same time, she was one of the most critical people in my life. And unfortunately, which made 1993 a terrible year, she died 3 months before my mother did. At exactly the same time, and I went to both funerals. And it was very difficult. And I did, although I'm not a Catholic, of course, I did participate in a Catholic high mass at her funeral, but I only, to the extent that I put my hand on her casket as they took it out of the, I asked them if I could do that. And they allowed me to do it. I didn't go to the funeral per se, but I, and she's buried out at a place called Queen of Heaven Cemetery out on Route 19, strangely enough, and near the Cannonsburg area, and near the Little Lake Theater, where I have been acting off and on for the last, since 1969.
So you had stayed in touch with her through the years?
No, actually I did not, strangely enough, show you what a nice person I am. No, I feel very bad about this. In 1984, my mother had her first series of strokes. The first stroke made her very made it difficult for her to walk, and but I decided to call Connie up, who at that point was 76 years of age and had long retired from the business of going into the house. She came into my mother's house, cleaned the entire house, moved all the furniture around. Now, this is a woman in her mid-70s. I don't know how she did it. And I asked her to stay around for a while. And then I got a whole bunch of nurses to come in and do round the clock with my mother because I didn't want her to, it was a difficult problem with the stroke that made it. But she could speak, and she could hear, and she could see, so it was okay. But I thought maybe Connie could at least get the ball rolling and get things started, because she was a great organizer, and she would clean. She used to clean everything in the house, and she would spend hours. She loved doing it. But that was the last time I saw her until the year before she died. And for some reason, I felt guilty about it. And in 1992, I found out that she was at Harmerville Rehabilitation Center because she had some physical things that were happening. And I visited her, and this is the first time in almost 20 years, although I had been in touch with her by phone occasionally, and we exchanged Christmas cards and birthday cards. But she wasn't feeling well, and she didn't look good, but she had that spirit, and she died, I think she was 80, wait a minute, I know exactly how old, because she was 4 years older than my mother, so she died at the age of 85. My mother died at the age of 81. But they were also very close, my mother and she, and I think she relied heavily on her, but I just found her to be the fun part of my life. So I thought I might add that back into this tape and, you know, give her a little due. Because she was extraordinary. The other thing I wanted to add is that when I ran the radio station at the University of Pittsburgh, it was a very makeshift situation, and we weren't really going anywhere. But I, when John Glenn was shot up as one of the first astronauts in space, we sent a reporter. I sent a reporter out to New Concord, Ohio, to interview Mr. Glenn. And then, of course, I was very excited. This is the winter of 1962, March of 1962, and there is the reporter. And I sent a guy named Dave Crawford, who is still in Pittsburgh and still acts and does voiceover work himself. He's got one of the best voices. In fact, KDK used him for many years on their station. He was the announcer. That, in effect, is a definition of voiceover work. Just the fact that you announce copy or announce, you know, or you know, you say this, the following program is brought to you by such and such, that's a voiceover, you know, in that sense. So I sent him out to New Concord, Ohio to interview John Glenn. Then we had this big radio program. And I thought I was going to be a big shot because everybody would think, wow, look at the radio station, their first big coup. I don't know who was listening because the thing went to the dorms at Pitt, and we didn't ever know exactly what was going on. But the radio station was a very big hit, and it's no longer what it was then. I mean, now it's just a straight music program. But I feel good that I and my best friend, Nathan Firestone, helped to put it on the air, and he was my program director, and we did nothing. We advertised ourselves as doing quality content programming, and that's what we did. We showed, we had radio programs, including, in fact, one night I ran Crap's Last Tape, because it was brand new in those days, and I played it. I don't think the audience understood it, but we did everything. We did political broadcasts, because Nate Firestone was a political enthusiast, and he wrote for the Pitt News, and we did all that. And it was a big deal, and I brought all my records in, and we played my records because nobody else had any records, and we didn't have the money. And when Chancellor Litchfield became the chancellor of the University of Pittsburgh in my senior year in 1962, he called me into his office. He was a big shot in Pittsburgh in those days, and he asked me if I needed anything at the radio station. And I said to him, no, we'll do it alone. That was very stupid of me because he offered me turntables and tape recorders and everything. I thought it would be better. I did it alone. And so we continued fumbling along, but finally, after I left, the University of Pittsburgh gave the radio station a lot of equipment.
What records did you play? Some of the tunes?
I don't know. It was the stuff that was, it was a combination of what was current at the time in the 1950s. Remember, this is 1960s. This is before the Beatles had arrived in the United States in 1964. I would say a lot of it. One night I remember playing an Al Jolson song, a record. I did some jazz. There was a group called the Ray Conniff Singers. I played their music. But this was stuff that I had collected, the Four Lads. This is a 50s musical phenomenon grafted onto the 60s, and I had a lot of I remember Jackie Wilson, who was a big rock and roll fan, singer rather, and I played one of his songs. But I did a number of rock and roll songs, because rock and roll was still really new at that point, about 8 years old, and Buddy Holly, Carl Perkins, Elvis Presley, obviously. I had some Elvis Presley records, and I played those. And one time I put some of my records on a radiator and they melted.
Ooh.
That was the end of my part of my record collection. But we had a very good time at that radio station. It got me through college in the sense that it gave me some place to go every day. But the station did not go on the air until my fourth year at Pitt. In 1958, when I became a freshman at Pitt, it was still not on the air, and I met a man named Adrian Kronauer, who was then the quote, general manager of WPGH. Now, Adrian Kronauer is famous because he is featured in a movie called Good Morning Vietnam with Robin Williams playing Adrian Kronauer. Now, Adrian Kronauer was, of course, an announcer. And what happened to Kronauer, but I never saw the movie, but I'm guessing that it's not in the movie. He just quit Pitt. I think his grades weren't so hot. And in his second year, he just left. And he moved on to other things. Obviously, he did get involved in the Vietnam War. And I lost track of him completely. And none of us liked him. We were all afraid of him. And I auditioned for him as an announcer by taking a pipe out of my... I said, I have a pipe. He said, sell it. And so that was my audition. I had to sell the pipe.
A smoking pipe or...?
A smoking pipe. No, it wasn't smoke. I mean, it was just the pipe without anything in it. And I never understood that audition. But anyhow, I got a job as an announcer, and I did a show called Club 700 or something. But the station was not on the air. We were just allocating people's name, people to this thing. And when in my first year, there was still no radio station. In my second year, there was still no radio station. And yet, there was an organization. And finally, Kronauer quit. The program director quit. That left this guy who was in the philosophy department named Dan Setti, and he says to me one day, calls me on the phone, he said, Richard, if you want the radio station, you can have it, and quits. And in my junior year, I'm left with an entire radio station that is still not on the air, and it took me two more years of my schooling at Pitt to finally find the right people, the right engineers, to figure out a way to put a transmitter, to get a transmitter to put our signal out on the Pitt campus. And we did by January of 1962, and I was the first person to turn the station on. And I played a song called Swonderful, which was the title of an album by Ray Conniff, and I just put the song on, and that was the first record, and then we continued doing programming during that entire winter year of 62. And then
what made you choose That's Wonderful?
Just because of its title.
Okay.
And because I felt pretty good about this. You know, finally, after 4 years, this damn thing was on the air, and I was very pleased that it happened. There were a lot of problems along the way, and I got into some hot water. I appointed a guy who was the head of the news department as the next general manager without informing the student board the administrative board, I guess it was. And they got very angry at me and demanded I apologize and recant and all this other stuff. But I did not get rid of him.
Who was the manager?
His name was Dan Johnson. He lives in New York. He still lives in West New York, New Jersey. I don't know what he does anymore, but he was at Pitt for a couple of years. He also was not a good choice, as a matter of fact. As a news person, he was the best choice of anybody. He had the ability to make the news department of the station excellent, and he even got a teletype machine, a UPI teletype machine in those days. But he made some strange deals, and the university got very upset and fired him. I'm not quite sure what happened, but they accused him of some kind of dirty dealing, and I never did know. And I felt bad about it because I thought he was the right person for the job, but anyway. But the station is no longer what we had in those days because obviously it conforms to what is going on in the world, which is the new music of today, of the 90s. But it was very, very satisfying to me that I was able to keep sticking with this station. I don't know why. I had nothing else to do, I guess. And so As a student, you know, I didn't like school that much. The radio station was something to do. I remember one day, I was at home, and this woman called me on the phone. She said, "I'm the mother of one of the students who works in your radio station, and you have caused my son to flunk out of school, and it's your fault." And I said, "No, it is not my fault. He hangs around the station all the time. We tell him to go study, and he won't do it. And he flunked out of school." Mm. And she was very angry at me. But I didn't feel that I had anything to do with it, other than the fact that I could have maybe been a little stronger about telling him not to show up, but he loved it. We all hung around. We all loved it. It was one of my favorite experiences as a student, because I did not act at Pitt when I was there. I had no interest in theater until I got to graduate school. And then a girl named Barbara Lyons said to me one day, "Why don't you do a play? Why don't you do a scene from a play called Love by Murray Siskel for the graduate class, and just do it?" And I find it very interesting that on Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the Jewish holiday, of the Jewish year, I went to Pitt to audition for her, this play. So I did it on Yom Kippur. And I guess that's a bad sign. I wasn't in the temple, and I wasn't fasting on that day, but I'm here reading a scene.
Did you get the part?
Yes. And it was a big hit. And from that point on, all the graduate students wanted to use me. I was in different scenes, and I kept doing that for the first... Meanwhile, I was in graduate school in the English department, not in the theater department. This was just something I did. And it was very gratifying. I learned a lot of acting that way.
What did your mother think of that?
She was pleased. Yeah. I think she wasn't much of a person who... people are surprised to hear this. She just didn't push me into theater. She used to say that the people in theater were boring anyway, and that why would I want to get into a profession like that? And I said, well, I don't know. And she didn't really help me much, as a matter of fact. The only time she did was when I was going to apply to CMU, and I never really did. I got scared. I was 17, and I thought, I can't do this. And they had told me that I had to... do two monologues in front of the faculty. I thought, I can't do this. And she told me she would help me if I would just let her. And I said, no, I can't do this. I'm going to go to Pitt. And that's it. And if I hadn't gone to Pitt, the radio station wouldn't have gone on the air as easily as it did, or as hard as it was. But she did not push me. Years later, I accused her of, in one of our arguments, that she should have helped me more. So, I mean, that's a typical reaction. And I, you know, she just said, well, I didn't, and that was the end of that. But later she was very proud of me, and she said one time that I was a better actor than she was. I don't know about that.
What did you think of her acting?
I thought she was one of the funniest comedy actresses I had seen, particularly because of her timing, which I learned by watching her. And it's the thing I do as an actor. My comedy is based on timing, and it is so critical. Every comic actor knows this. It's more work than doing a serious play.
I guess Jack Benny was one of the geniuses.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think I identify with Benny. I watch his tapes, watch the way he does stuff. And in fact, some people say I sound like Benny sometimes. And I've done that. I've been talking, you know, I get like Rochester and Don, and that kind of the cadence of his voice, but I'm not really like that. But the timing is so critical, and that was, I've been working on that for years. You can't learn it in class. You just have to do it.
I'm going to move just for 2 seconds. Since you're such a, you know, you obviously are very attached to the theater, are you a big theater goer?
Yes. I go to New York as much as I can and see shows there, although recently I'm a little more disenchanted with some of the things I'm seeing there. But I see a lot of theater, and I now write, since this tape was made, I now write drama reviews for the Post-Gazette occasionally. I'm called a stringer. I work for Chris Rawson at the Post-Gazette, and occasionally when he has shows he doesn't want to see, he sends me out. I'm one of four stringers. Last year I did 20 plays. I reviewed 20 plays in the Pittsburgh area. This began in the winter In the winter of 1995 is when I started writing reviews for the Post-Gazette. I've written also three reviews for the weekly newspaper called In Pittsburgh, but only occasionally. But the bulk of my writing is now for the Post-Gazette, and it's very gratifying to do it, although it's very hard to do it, and I spend a lot of time. When I first started doing it, I was spending hours, 8-10 hours a day trying to get this to work, and then I learned how to do it faster. Maybe I can now do a review in 3 to 4 hours if I have to. And the less time I'm given, the better off I am.
So what are some of the... You said Samuel Beckett is one of the finest playwrights of the 20th century. Who else would you...
call a great playwright in the 20th century? Well,
fine plays and...
I would certainly... certainly Arthur Miller, who is still alive. He's now 82. He's written, of course, Death of a Salesman and A View from the Bridge, which is currently appearing in New York. All My Sons by Arthur Miller. I've always liked Miller. I don't know what his place in The Crucible, what his place in literature will be, but I think it'll be pretty strong. Tennessee Williams is always good. His early stuff is particularly strong. I don't like his later stuff as much, but of course, Glass Menagerie, Streetcar Named Desire, and maybe stuff like Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, which I like, and Sweet Bird of Youth, Orpheus Descending, I'm not too thrilled about. But his early stuff is good. Edward Albee, I've never been too hot on, but his last play that he wrote, Three Tall Women, is worth the price of admission. It's just a terrific play. And his early stuff, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and The Zoo Story. Now, The Zoo Story, by the way, will be on a double bill with a play I'm doing, Crap's Last Tape. And then these two plays will be done in July. And I said to the producer, why are you doing two serious, depressing plays in July when everybody wants to go outside and have fun? But that's what they're doing. So anyway, Albee's early stuff and then the most recent stuff would give him some marks as a playwright. I also like occasionally Philip Barry, who used to write high comedy. He wrote The Philadelphia Story. And there are some other playwrights, David Mamet, and more recently Christopher Durang, who I enjoy. He's a very funny playwright. The English lady, Carol Churchill, who's written stuff like Top Girls and Cloud Nine, is very, very good. I enjoy her stuff. I can't think of anybody right now.
How about O'Neill?
O'Neill I like, but only his mature works. I like The Hairy Eight, which he did in 1921, but a lot of his experimental theater I've not really gotten excited about. The Great God Brown, Morning Becomes Electra, Strange Interlude, Lazarus, I forgot the title, Dynamo, is an idiotic play, but his last stuff, Iceman Cometh, Moon for the Misbegotten, Touch of the Poet, and especially my favorite play, Long Day's Journey in the Night, I think are wonderful plays. And that's my favorite. Yeah, that's my favorite play.
Did you see it at the public theater?
No, I didn't get a chance to see it. But when I was in New York recently, I got a chance to see Olivier's version of it, which I had not seen. It was done in 1973 on television. And it's pretty good. I mean, Olivier being the great, I think he's the greatest actor of our time. To watch him play the father was really exciting. It used to be The Death of Sales was my favorite play, but now it's Long Day's Journey. I think it's a most extraordinary examination of a family that I've ever seen. And Death of Sales certainly is hardly a secondary kind of experience. I mean, it's a very... exciting look at a man in decline, and it really does encapsulate a lot of Miller's themes that he repeated over and over again. And I've got to like much more so now The Crucible. I think it's a very strong play, and for our times, it's particularly interesting. So yeah, my interest in theater is pretty strong, although I, you know, going to New York and seeing lousy theater doesn't help, and I've seen some really bad shows recently.
Okay.
I went to see Steel Pier, a musical. I didn't like that. I thought it was dreadful. A play that everybody does like called The Life. It's a musical about prostitutes in New York City. I didn't like that much. I went to see a very unusual version of The Doll's House.
Yeah.
No, but everybody tells me I'm crazy. So.
I saw it in Bath. I thought she was surprised.
Yeah, well, you have to buy into her, and I was very tired the day I saw it, and I don't know if it was... I think it's an interesting version of it. I think they change... I kind of like the way Torvald is...